Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that the word pink used to mean yellow. The oldest definition of the word pink, which dates back to the early 1400s, is a murky, yellowish pigment made by combining vegetable coloring matter with a white base. The theory for this murky, yellow origin is that the name pink derives from an older German word, pinkeln, meaning to urinate. It wasn't until the mid-17th century that we start to see pink referred to as the pale reddish color we know today, so what happened? Well, Queen Elizabeth I happened, for one. You see, toward the end of the monarch's reign, the Virgin Queen acquired a real fondness for carnations. Now, carnations have their own unique origin story. They date back to Greek and Roman times when they were used as ceremonial crowns. The name carnation comes from the Latin word carne, meaning flesh. The flesh referring to the flower's light blush and peach coloring. Now, carnations started to pop up around England sometime in the 16th century. They were nicknamed pinks, but confusingly not yet for their color, but for their rumpled-looking petals, which looked like they were snipped by something called pinking shears. These are scissors with a serrated edge. Now, as you can tell, the word pink is being used at this time, but still not yet for the pigment. But once Elizabeth started fancying these flowers, their popularity grew. You could find them all across Elizabethan England. And given the carnation's newfound fame, their delicate hue, and, of course, their nickname, the old definition of pink as a yellowish pigment was soon forced out of use, making room for its new one, a color intermediate between red and white as of coral or salmon. Curiously, though, that old definition isn't entirely extinct. You can still find it in niche corners of the artistic world. Watercolorists and artists refer to it more specifically as Dutch pink. This week I learned a provocative new evolutionary theory of how our aquatic ancestors made the leap from sea to land. A new study from Northwestern University says it was vision, not limbs, that led fish onto land 385 million years ago. Scientists studied fossil records and found that the size of eyes nearly tripled before, not after, the water-to-land transition. This bump in size also coincided with a shift in the location of the eyes from the side of the head to the top of it. Now, for fish, bigger eyes really aren't doing them any favors underwater. It's way too murky, you can't see anything anyway. But when those eyes were able to pop above the water's surface, they could see 70 times farther in air than in water. And what those fish were likely seeing was a cornucopia of food available to them on land. And scientists believe this visible feast likely pushed evolution to turn those fins into limbs and get those creatures onto land. Once those early terrestrial vertebrates got onto land, their big eyes really started to work for them. Scientists believe the improved vision helped to develop bigger brains, and that improved complex cognition changed the way they think, making room for humans. Now, fish, because they're in water, have limited eyesight, so they're forced to just react to a situation with split-second speed. But on land, these creatures start developing brains that now have the ability to plan instead of react, to weigh options and choose strategically. This is called perspective cognition, and it's something we humans have today. But the eye size is really interesting when you start looking at animals who decided to return back to the water after some time on land. When they're back in those murky depths, their eyes actually shrink back down to the size that are typically found in fish. This all sounds pretty nicely packaged, I'm sure. Bigger eyes, location shift, and voila, we're on land. But the reality is, evolution is crazy slow. Researchers say that tripling size of the eyes took a mind-boggling 12 million years to develop. This week I learned that the brains of blind people can rewire themselves to enhance their other abilities. A report published in the Journal Plus One looks at the structural, functional, and anatomical changes that happen in the brains of people who are born with blindness. Researchers use brain imaging technology on 12 subjects who were either born blind or became blind by the age of 3. They compared those scans to those of 16 normally sighted subjects. What they found is that in the absence of visual information, a blind person's brain makes new connections within the brain to boost the other senses and ultimately to think and function better. This is the cool thing about the human brain. It has the ability to naturally adapt to our experiences. So even if you're blind and can't see the world, your brain is working to access the information that is available to it so that it can interact with the environment in a more effective manner. In the brains of blind people, researchers found heightened senses of hearing, smell, and touch. But the changes weren't limited to just senses. Researchers also found heightened cognitive functions like memory and language. And if this is the brain's natural process to adapt and enhance, then who knows what kind of potential could exist with some training? Perhaps we'll have some superheroes on our hands. This week I learned that Jane Austen may have been a fantastically mischievous teenager. Austen was born in 1775 in a rural village in Hampshire in southern England. An archivist there recently discovered 2 fake marriage documents written by Austen herself. Jane Austen, of course, wrote insightful tales of manners, matchmaking, and status of 18th century society. And though she exhibited a keen eye toward the silly social norms of love and marriage, Austen herself never married. She died single at the age of 41. But these 2 marriage documents announce unions with 2 men it's believed she just made up. One gent was named Henry Fitzwilliam of London, the other called Edmund Mortimer of Liverpool. At the time, these kinds of marriage announcements were put out as a public register by the church, and Austen likely had access to that register because her father was the rector of the local parish. Jane was likely just a teenager at the time the documents were written, so fake marriage announcements could have been a bit of writerly practice for the future author, or maybe it just reveals a delightfully mischievous side to this classic of British literature. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned or check out more podcasts from the week, you can go to theweek.com/podcasts. And as a thank you for listening to this podcast, we at The Week would like to offer you 4 totally free, non-commitment issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. And thanks so much for listening.